Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Box Set Pod. It's summertime, or it feels like it. It's still a bit nippy up north, but the sun is out and it's turning beautiful. The days are getting longer and the podcasts will, no doubt, get shorter. My name is Howell, this is Jamie.
Yeah.
And now live from London, Matthew Wanless.
Live from London.
Matt, are you Jewish?
There's a lot of Jewish in my family, but...
Okay.
I don't... My dad's side is not Jewish, my mum's side is. But,
Jamie is not Jewish either. We're about to discuss a TV series that has been written by, if not an entirely Jewish person, certainly half Jewish, Amy Sherman Palladino. And none of us are Jewish people. So, and none of us are women either, and this is a very female-centric story as well. So,
I mean, Hirsch is my middle name.
Is it really? Okay, we're in. And that'll do. Unfortunately, Mel couldn't join us. Mel from Kansas would have at least brought with it a female perspective. And she's obviously a big Amy Sherman Palladino fan because Amy Sherman Palladino wrote The Gilmore Girls. Oh, yes.
Did she indeed?
Yeah.
Okay.
It feels like the moment where she's finally written something good, doesn't it? She's done it.
Well, I would say that the seven series of The Gilmore Girls was good, but I would also say this shows what happens when you give a writer like that unlimited budget. You know, so, like really, well, that's what this is. It's look, you can do what you want. All of these outside shots of New York that we see. All of that stuff, like super expensive stuff to shoot that you'd never get to see in a normal series.
I was thinking about this the other day. I was because I've started watching Seinfeld from the beginning, and I was thinking about you and your fucking old big budget, big good show. And I was thinking about the West Wing as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the budget was for the West Wing.
Yeah.
But I imagine it would pale in comparison to something like Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And I just think I just don't see the correlation. I think
you've completely misunderstood any argument that I make. The only reason I brought up budgets recently was what you managed to do with a budget. So in this case, I would say that what Amy Sherman Palladino has done has spent an unlimited budget really, really well, and the pace is kept up, and it's like it's a really engaging thing, I think. The only reason why I brought it up in the past was to do with wallowing in riches, watching someone roll around in riches. The West Wing is a great example of the first season of The West Wing. You know, they certainly got massive budgets, and it got bigger as time went on with their success. But the first series of The West Wing, yeah, great example. You can do a lot with little, and you can do a lot in 27 minutes, which I think is what The West Wing is, isn't it? Or
27 minutes. It's 45.
You can get a lot in with great talented people. In the Netflix world, I feel like episode that, you know, the pilot of The West Wing would be the entire first series. Whereas,
you get
tangled up in your own arguments. Honestly,
Absolutely right, Matt. We should get into. We're talking about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Howell, why don't you give us a brief synopsis of the storyline behind The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is on Amazon Prime?
Well, to put you in the same world, perhaps this is kind of in the same city as Mad Men, around the same time as Mad Men, and down the road from that place is
Madison Avenue.
Madison Avenue. And I suppose her husband works on Madison Avenue, doesn't he? But he doesn't quite know what he is. He's like the real Don Draper, bit of a useless Don Draper. Doesn't quite know what he sells, isn't very passionate about it. Mr. Maisel wants to be a stand-up comic. Mrs. Maisel is his wife, who is the perfect housewife. She is... she makes sure that she's beautiful, well organized, well prepared all the time. She's also an incredibly smart
every day
person.
Every day she measures her waistline and her thighs and everything so that she stays to a certain sort of figure, hugging, you know,
like a
figure,
metric. Sort of,
yeah.
And the woman Joel, metric.
Joel is the name of her husband, and he's got aspersions. He's got aspirations to be a stand-up comic. So he'll go to the what they call the Gaslight in downtown in Queens. Not Queens, what am I talking about? What's that bit of New York? It's like
Brooklyn? It's Soho, isn't it?
Soho. Yeah. Yeah.
Or Greenwich.
Yeah. Greenwich, that's it. Greenwich Village.
And he wants to get on stage at one of these open mic type nights where you get yourself a slot. If his slot is very late, 2 a.m, well, Mrs. Maisel will go up and sweeten the deal by offering some home-baked goods to the person who does the running order, and he'll find himself on at 10 o'clock. He isn't a great comedian. She is the one who is the driving force behind everything and is perhaps smarter than him. And in episode 1, in the pilot, he bombs on stage. We perhaps get the sense that she is taking more notes and thinking about this thing better than he is. We also learn that
he's plagiarizing.
Plagiarizing his act. And he leaves her. He announces he's been having an affair with his secretary and leaves her. And as a result of that, you have to remind me where the pilot ends. She gets on stage, yes?
Yep.
Yeah,
she gets on stage. He leaves her. She gets drunk. She goes to the Gaslight, and she kind of vents off her frustration and her dismay at her husband leaving her. And it's a very funny stand-up performance. She doesn't realise she's becoming a stand-up comedian, but this is the first step on her road to becoming a comedian.
And there we got a show. That's the setup.
And like you said, the Gaslight's in there. There's a lot of references and a lot of real historical figures in, such as Lenny Bruce is in it. And so there's a lot of real sort of events and happenings around what she is experiencing. And she is based, the character she's based on is loosely kind of around Joan Rivers, isn't it? It's that kind of...
Is that right?
I
didn't know that.
Yeah, I think that she was a mixture between Joan Rivers and there's another female comic of that period that she's kind of based around as well. An amalgamation of sort of these two sort of big comics that arose in the American comedy scene in that period of time.
And Amy Sherman tends to write quite about things she knows very well. Bunheads she wrote, and she was a dancer once, thinking a big fan of sort of dance and ballet and stuff. But also her father was a stand-up comic, so it's very, I think all of the comedy in this is very well done, and they've used, you know, consultants in terms of comedic stuff. Do you agree with that? Is the comedy well done? Did it make you laugh out loud at any point along with the
comedy? Well,
should it though?
I definitely should. And that was one of the big things. Like, it was almost a deal breaker. Like, if this is going to work, she has to be on stage and it has to be funny. The material has to be funny. Mm. Otherwise, you're just watching a really like average comedy show where everyone's pretending it's really good, and it is really good. When she's on stage, she's genuinely brilliant. And the performance of Rachel Brosnahan, who's also from House of Cards, and she's brilliant in that. I can't believe it's the same person.
Yeah,
but she's superb, and she's a delivery, and it's just an incredibly well-rounded performance, and it's very funny. I laughed a lot during the stand-up stuff.
I don't agree with that. I think it's the weakest part of the show.
Well, she doesn't make Matt laugh out loud. And I agree with Matt there, but I also think, with hindsight, I think most comedy in the 50s, if you listen to it, isn't funny. It doesn't make us today laugh out loud. But I think at the time, they would have found that incredibly funny. You know, you're getting arrested at the side of the stage for doing those kinds of things.
I think there's some genuinely funny bits that she does on stage. You know, this is we laughed quite a lot during the film. I know there's the shock element for the audience of that period of time, but I thought she did some really good stuff.
I mean, I haven't seen the whole series, but
Really? What have you watched up to, Matt?
Maybe four or five.
Right, that's quite early on. Yeah, there's a few more sort of stand-up moments within the show to come, but I mean, yeah.
I think it's a very difficult thing to capture in a drama.
Yeah, I agree.
And for someone, it's also a very rare thing to find someone who can play a part and do stand up. I think that's they are probably very, very rare beasts, I would think.
So, did you not enjoy? Is it her performance as well that you're not a fan of?
Which. Her overall performance or just the stand-up?
The actress.
No. I think for the most part, she's very good in it. I mean, the show has that kind of heightened characterization that I do associate a little bit with Mad Men, particularly early Mad Men. And I felt like, sorry to just instantly start making comparisons, but they're set in such similar worlds. Mad Men settled into itself a bit, and that was when it really got going for me, because I wasn't sold on Mad Men for about 8 episodes. And maybe this will be the same.
No, I don't think it'll settle in the same way, because I just think it's a comedy and it's going to remain. This is musical theatre, isn't it, without songs? That's
I mean, it is a comedy, isn't it? It definitely has that about it. But it is a kind of very different take on the same era. You know, it has that kind of big band brass intro sort of feel about it.
Oh, the music is brilliant. The music is just great. They spent a lot of time on that.
I don't know why, but does it turn into a kind of musical?
No, but I think it feels like that, and I think
I sort of had the vague idea in my head that was supposed to happen at some point, but I don't know why I thought that.
At the same time Aaron Sorkin was making West Wing on the Warner Brothers lot, Amy Sherman was making The Gilmore Girls on the Warner Brothers lot. So the cast would have been...
Yes, I remember hearing something about that.
And both of them are renowned for writing scripts that are twice as long as other people's scripts, because their word count is so fast. And it was kind of... Gilmore Girls was kind of described as like the goy, as in the non-Jewish Jewish show on TV, because everyone in it were white, waspy, Massachusetts type characters, but they all spoke like Jews and with Jewish humour, and again, that's where I think Jamie's right in terms of this feels like what she's been building up to her whole career, because suddenly you have Jewish characters playing all this stuff. Alex Borstein, for example, who's brilliant, who's as Susie, she has always appeared in little bits of Amy Sherman stuff. But did you know, Jamie, the original idea was that Alex Borstein was going to be the character of Luke in Gilmore Girls. So she would have been the grumpy coffee shop owner, which would make total sense. But of course, the networks back then went, no, we just can't have this many girls. We need a man in there. We need a love interest, and put that in. So again, it is sort of all, you know, they were all heading in this direction, I think. Tony Shalhoub is brilliant, don't you think? The dad?
Like him in it. Yeah, very good.
I think the cast are great. I think everybody in it, I really enjoy it. I think this is a heightened, like you said, it does feel like a musical.
Yeah.
It's a heightened version of New York, and it has that fast pace, and it's very colourful, and the music is superb. And it dances on that line between comedy and drama very nicely, like the Gilmore Girls does in a lot of ways. So it works out. For me, I don't really see much comparison with Mad Men other than the time period.
Well, I feel like Amy Sherman and Daniel So Amy Sherman's husband is Daniel Palladino, who produced Family Guy, and he writes the odd episode of this. And I can almost guarantee that the episode that you like less will be the one that Daniel wrote, and it's the same in the Gilmore Girls. The girl does it better, and Daniel's becomes more about dick jokes and stuff. And it's the same in this. You get more sort of harsher male humour. It becomes a bit less sort of formed. But I don't doubt for a second that the two of them, husband and wife team, sat there and went, let's do the real... The our version of Mad Men, you know, down the road from Mad Men, there's this happening. What's the music that the downtown Sinatra, Nancy Sinatra, isn't it? They play it's the Chinatown bit. Ding 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 ding. Borderline Offensive. When they first go to the gas lamp, that's the music that kicks in.
Right. Yeah.
And so, yeah, yes, I think that it was a conscious thing. I think they knew that they were going to be taking on that world, the sort of alternative Mad Men.
I think
I was just going to say it's kind of, Mad Men is a very male-centric show.
Yeah.
And very much looking at the kind of, the evolution of the male persona alongside the evolution of capitalism.
Yeah.
And this is a very subversive take on that, where it's looking at it from an entirely different perspective altogether, and looking at it from, you know, from how a woman was groomed to be at that period, and then having her completely flip that on its head and go and do something entirely different.
Yeah.
And
Joel, you know, Joel is useless, isn't he? I mean,
it's interesting that there is that tie to that specific area of business, yeah. And that kind of culture with the secretaries and the drinking and the kind of public appearances. Because rather than Don Draper, he for me reminds me of Pete Campbell. Yeah. That's who I think of.
Yeah, exactly.
The loser with the chip on his shoulder about being someone special.
Yeah. Although I think he's more likable than Pete. I do like Joel as a character all the way through. I think that's one of the things that the Palladinos do really well, I think, is that they write these characters that do bad things. And you can still kind of root for him. I'm still rooting for Joel. I kind of don't. Really? Yeah, are you not, Jamie? Do you?
I haven't seen that far into it. I hate Joel.
Yeah,
I was. I mean, I felt like I didn't like him at all, and I felt very much like I really don't want her to get back together with him at any point during this show.
Of course, but you still managed to feel some sympathy for him. Because, well, why do you?
No,
think
I was done with him for the moment he was taking someone else's material.
That was it. Why do you think he split up with his wife? What was it that he couldn't handle about being with Midge?
I think that he almost says, doesn't he, that he knows he's in some way disappointing her, or he doesn't feel like. I mean, he doesn't want the responsibility. He doesn't want to feel like a failure. And I think he probably subconsciously realizes that his wife is maybe more talented than him.
Yeah.
And has a superior sort of intelligence to him and a desire than him to sort of progress in this comic world. And he feels like he can't live up to those expectations. And the secretary that he meets, he feels more comfort in that world, and then even that doesn't satisfy him. Well, that's more the plot anyway, but I mean, yeah. Why, what do you think?
I agree completely. I just struggled to work that out at the time. It's an incredibly modern, it's perfect for now. You know, what we're learning at the moment is that white men need to shut up and accept that you're going to lose to other people for a change. And you need to, you know, accept that other people can be more talented and have opportunities than you because you've had opportunities forever. And what they've done is they've taken that and they've put it in the 50s at a time when nobody else would be saying to someone like Joel, it's okay for your wife to be more, have more opportunity than you. In fact, they'd be saying the opposite. They'd be saying, you must be the breadwinner and she must be at home, you know. And Joel can't handle that. And it's kind of understandable that he can't handle that, because that's the social pressure.
Well, I really like how it comes about as well, because it's all down to her trying to change a bit of his act to try and make it better.
Yeah.
And because he has no skill at it and no feel for it, and he's stealing someone else's shtick anyway.
Yeah.
When he tries to do that, he absolutely fumbles it. And he hasn't got a slot in the Gasland, because the people who think that he is shit don't want to give it to him. She's the only reason he's been getting on at good times. Mm. And then when his friends are there, everything just falls to pieces, because Susie won't bow down to, you know, she won't be won over with a pot pie or a pot roast or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then he's, you know, fully exposed to the elements,
yeah,
and in front of his friends, and he's just torn to pieces in the worst way possible. Because I don't know, I mean, I've never been a professional stand-up, but I did do some stand-up
did
when
you?
I was at university.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And wow. there is nothing worse,
yeah,
than bombing at stand-up. I've dried as an actor on stage. And in that realm, it's 10 times worse.
Yeah.
Because it's so unrescuable. There's no one else to help you, and you're entirely alone. And they call it dying for a reason.
Yeah.
How
many times did you do stand up?
I did it quite a lot. My university offered it as a speciality in the fourth year.
Ooh.
You basically did one module for your final year.
Yeah,
and me and Tiernan both did stand up that year.
Wow!
Oh, really?
Tiernan carried on with it. And what was you? What would you say your ratio was of bombing to succeeding?
I mean, I enjoyed a fairly good time of it, but we had we were performing to our own peers at university, so it was like the most friendly crowd you could imagine.
Yeah. Did you ever take it beyond that? Did you ever try it on?
I did a little bit in London. To moderately successfully, but I didn't want to do it enough.
Can you remember what your opening line was?
I didn't have any. That was the thing. I wasn't very good at I didn't like the way stand up works, which is you take a set, you find 5 minutes of good stuff, and you clone it and you hone it and you hone it.
Yeah.
I liked to
go
improvise,
vibe it out.
But it's kind of an unsustainable thing to do.
Wow. Did you always know
unless you're really really talented?
Yeah.
Did you always feel like Tiernan would continue and do well?
He loved it straight away, and he was really organised about it as well. That was the other thing. I couldn't be dealing with the lifestyle of it.
Mm. Right.
It's so hard. You have to really want to, and I didn't want it enough.
Well, I think one of the things the series is really good at is charting the sort of the rise and fall of that journey of she's working. Yeah. I mean, in the pilot, she's working on adrenaline and she's nailing it. And the question is, how long can you?
Sorry, I just realised I didn't actually finish the point.
Yeah, go on.
Which is that? So that's what happens, and he puts it down to her. He dies because of something that he suggested. Yes. That's how he sees it. He doesn't see it as anything to do with him.
And she's got that great line, and she says, "Because you killed it." He says something like, "You know, it was your line," and she says, "Yeah, but you killed it." And that's when you know. That's almost when she shows her teeth, isn't it? When it's like, "Yeah, she really is smarter than you. She does know what she's doing more than you on this."
I think that that is great, and I think that. There's two things for me that have to be good in this show and really matter. And the first is like the fascination of watching, especially a female comic, try and make it in that era. It's fascinating. I think it's really well done. And although this is a heightened reality, it feels very real, like the journey that she's going on. That doesn't feel like it's a phony journey. The other thing it relies heavily on is her relationship with Susie. Mm. Them two together are brilliant, and the Alex Borstein who plays Susie is really good, and brilliant. Both of them together, the scenes between those two are wonderful. There's really this dynamic that builds, and there's this intimacy and this relationship that's about stronger than her relationship with her father, with her, sorry, with her husband. You know, it's her relationship with her is so much more interesting and worthwhile. That's for me why this show is very good and compelling watching.
There isn't a weak cast member either.
No. I mean, really, you've got Kevin Pollak as the dad of
Joel's dad.
The knobhead husband. Yeah, and he's brilliant.
But Tony Shalhoub as Abe is one of my favourite characters. The podcast about Gilmore Girls that I listened to went on to talk about this, and one of the things they pointed out with him is that he sings his lines, and just pay attention to that, and he does, doesn't he? It's just amazing.
I love the bit where he says that, like, they move back in, and the kid is watching Howdy Doody.
Yeah.
And he said, and he's like, I need silence. I have to do my reading. And she says, look, just let him watch Howdy Doody. Otherwise, you know. And he's like, no, this is my house, and I will not be here. Yeah. Picks the kid up, but he just screams. And he's like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Please just let him, just stop him, please.
There's another great, in one of the later episodes, right? I'm not going to spoil anything now. I'm just going to say that Tony Shalhoub's character gets wound up more and more to the point that, let's say, Jamie, he's built a metaphorical castle that he's standing in to protect himself.
Yeah.
You know the bit I'm talking about.
I know which episode you're talking about. Yeah, it's very funny.
And then Midge comes and tells him something that he doesn't want to hear. You expect him to be happy, and he goes, no! And does this massive pantomime about why she shouldn't. He's so good. So good.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about it as well is how the skills that she has because of what she's been for most of her life make her this kind of unstoppable force.
Yeah.
When she decides to break out of it.
Perfect grenade. Comedy grenade.
And she's just like, she's hyper-organized. She's just, you know, my wife and I were reading this comic strip about the mental loads that women take on in a marriage. Mm. And when you look at the things, I know that I'm guilty of it. There are things that Hannah thinks of that it doesn't even occur to me. Mm. And so when someone with that kind of mental capacity starts coming into a world which is traditionally dominated by people who are fucking lazy, like, it, you know, when you look at the kind of powerful male characters in this show and in Mad Men as well, they're just so kind of incapable in a way. And so when someone comes in there who's like, what are you doing, and it's quite stark, and I really like that.
Yeah. Have you seen the episode where she's honing her material, Matt? Have you seen that bit yet?
I can't remember.
Because that's a really good scene. And I thought that was brilliantly done because, first of all, every time she takes the material and she tries it different ways until eventually she kills with it. She genuinely gets that material to a point where you go, oh, that really is the funny way of doing it. Yeah. And it's really well done. Like, I really like the way they put it. It's like a Rocky montage, but it's really well done with comedy.
What an interesting thing to try and show, because I would imagine that'd be really difficult to capture.
Yeah, and they just they've consulted with stand-ups, so they've got a couple of regular consultants, I think, and they've really charted that progress really well. We've never done stand-up, but Jamie and I have had to work on word economy for lots of reasons, I suppose. And that kind of creative process is really rarely shown on screen, isn't it? You don't see things like that on screen very often. And it's great. That's the kind of behind-the-curtain stuff that I really love watching.
It's like, it's nice to see the work that goes in to make something look effortless, you know. That's what you don't get a lot of in TV, and to put it into a comedy drama, to really feel like, oh, you're seeing the process when people say, anyone could do that. Well, actually, look at all the hard work that you have to do to get to that point.
People would never guess that this podcast is scripted, and this is like draft 5. The turnaround is unbelievable. I think you laughed slightly early on that line, guys. We would,
yeah. Can we do that again?
Do that again. Go back.
People don't realise that even this. People don't realise that like this podcast is scripted. It's actually draft 5 of the podcast. Great.
That's
great.
Better.
That's better. Nailed it.
Where were we? So, yeah. So it's really nice to see process stuff. And one other thing is. Stating the obvious again, but like I think in the Gilmore Girls, in say the first two series of the Gilmore Girls, I reckon there's one scene when two men have a conversation, and you don't realise it when you're watching it, but when you compare it with what was going on, like in the West Wing, where Alison Janney stands alone really as a sort of strong female character, this writer has been doing it for ages. And not only that, why am I listening to someone? It sounds like somebody's licking cream out of a tub. What the hell was that?
Sorry, I've moved a little bit away from the router. Sorry.
Okay.
Am I still clear?
No. Did you go in the fridge, Matt?
No. Carry on.
So the two things that I think Amy Sherman has always done really well, and I urge you to go back and watch the Gilmore Girls and put up with its lower budget, is number one, really good female characters talking to each other, not needing men, and by calling her show The Gilmore Girls, being instantly sort of snobbed at, being disrespected compared to the male writers of the time in the 90s, who were also huge, like Aaron Sorkin. She's up there with them, and she does that really well. And the other thing she does really well is if you read a Gilmore Girls script, if you watch the Gilmore Girls, it is almost all about the comedy. Now, it might not be like hilarious jokes, but the scripts are written as setups and punchlines almost always, apart from the conversations with the mother. And even those are quite quite punchline heavy, even though they're very, very rooted in emotion and people trying to hurt each other with punchlines. So again, it's... all of this is to say more reasons to watch The Fabulous Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, if you haven't watched it, is that you can go back further than this and watch the roots of all this taking place. But it's so good, and it's so satisfying finally to see that writer and her husband able to write stuff. It's basically the story of Midge and Joel, but they stay together. You know, the Daniel Palladino has to take the back seat to Amy Sherman Palladino. And probably knows that he's not as good a writer. And yeah, so they're just great. And it's just fantastic to see that sort of come out of the gate. Even if I didn't know it was them, I would say all of my... Like, not one of my issues to do with pace or any of that comes into play with this stuff. It could be. They're like 50 minutes to an hour, aren't they?
No, they're about 30 minutes each, aren't they? I think.
No.
I'm about that.
No.
Sure, they're not that long. I mean, yeah, it could have gone. The first episode could have gone either way for me, because there was a moment where I was not sure I was going to like the character of Midge, and you know, it teetered on the edge at times of being a bit. You know, I was worried that she was going to be a bit too much of a stereotype, and then she won me round, and she's brilliant in it. And if you get to that point.
Go on, sorry.
No, it's all right.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, the reason I haven't seen it all is because I stopped watching it.
Yeah, wow. Okay. 57 minutes, the first episode, Jamie.
It wasn't a conscious choice, really. I just kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
Right.
So it must, you know, I've been saying some nice stuff about it, but the... you know, it didn't hook me in so far that I felt like I absolutely had to carry on.
Were you watching alone or with your wife?
Well, I watched a couple of episodes alone, then I tried to get Hannah on board and she didn't grab onto it, and then I watched a couple more by myself and then I stopped watching it.
Okay. I think it's definitely one to watch with your partner. It's almost like an event, not event TV, but it's a good laugh along thing, doesn't it? Comedy's never good on your own.
It's a great one to watch after watching something heavy as well. I think we just watched something pretty heavy. Maybe it might have been sort of I don't know if Handmaid's Tale or something like that. We might have been, it was something quite, you know, full of darkness. And to watch this afterwards was really refreshing and enjoyable and pacey It does depend on how you're coming into it, but I mean, and also, like you said, if you're trying to watch it outside of your time with your lady friend, it's not going to be easy.
I think as well, there's a thing about Amy Sherman that is that her as a person is like a sort of gothy steampunk hat wearing person who loves British rock and indie and sees herself as different from the crowd, not one of the cool kids. And almost all of her comedy, almost all of her writing is about being a little bit inverted snob about the world and pokes fun at sincere things. And it's a little bit, what's the word? Not irresponsible. Simple word. Not
irreverent.
Irreverent and doesn't take things seriously. Punches the balloon all the time. And it's really nice to see somebody decide to make TV which has a heart, but quite often it does take you a while to see that heart because it's really just trying to be witty, you know. And at first you go, oh, that's annoying. And once you get into it, once you get those moments, like later on when Midge is talking to Susie, they're eating late at night and they're talking about their career and stuff, and they have a couple of moments where they bond, and you'll just get, in all of this people being witty, you'll get three lines where someone just says something really touching, and it means so much more.
Definitely.
I don't know how, but you're talking me out of it. When you start waxing lyrical about something like this, it just makes me go, can't do that.
I'm doing the opposite of what I'm saying. I'm taking it too seriously. But that's why I like it, is that it's really cleverly not trying to look important, you know. And Sorkin was very, very good at what he did, but it was also an incredibly self-important show, The West Wing.
Don't start like trying to bring down Sorkin with it. don't do that.
Its point of difference is very knowing, but it also makes it look quite thin when it's got depth.
The question is this, Matt. Will you, after hearing these thoughts, are you going to go back and finish that bad boy?
With your wife?
I might well do. I don't think I'm going to get my wife into it. She didn't like it very much.
Oh, all right. Well, you carry on then. But get to the end of it. The very end of the series, I think, is an absolutely fantastic moment. Like the last 10 seconds of the series, I think it's brilliant. It really makes you want a second series. And I hope they stick to what they've set up, you know. Hope it doesn't,
you know,
Joel thing.
Yeah. Speaking of the West Wing, I've been listening to the West Wing weekly podcasts.
Oh, how annoyed are you that you didn't go to the London show?
Oh my god, I didn't even know there was a London show. When was that?
It's the last episode, like a few weeks ago they were in London, and before that they were in Dublin.
Are you fucking joking?
No.
My god, I'm so furious.
Yeah.
I'm so furious now.
I know.
I would have totally gone to that.
And Richard Schiff was on stage with them.
No. This is like a body blow. This is horrible.
I'm starting to hate them. I'm really starting to hate the smugness of the delivery of West Wing Weekly, you know.
Well, I've listened to 10, I think, but I mean, I've listened to that in the last week, which is a lot, I've just finished listening to the one where Richard Schiff is on it, actually, when they're talking about the first Christmas episode, and he cries. I know, and I didn't think I could love Richard Schiff a lot more, but I thought he was brilliant on it, even though he was so kind of like driving home the point about being humble, to the point where it's like, are you actually that humble? I just love it, and it's so nice to kind of revisit the episode, and I like the fact that they're critical of the show as well,
but they just
like,
don't,
particularly Josh Molina is really trying to poke holes in
the fuck is this
in episodes
an
when,
advert for the West Wing Weekly an advert for a podcast that the last thing it needs is an advert for itself on on a podcast.
Yeah, we need an answer
instead of this. Instead of this.
Oh, right. End this madness.
I'm starting to really hate podcasts that are really successful really easily. Like,
no, me too.
Guess what? If you get Josh Molina and Richard Schiff involved, you can make $1 million really quickly and go, oh, look what happened to our successful podcast. Isn't that easy?
Yeah.
I tell you what, I've got a podcast recommendation. Listen to Colin Murray at Home and listen to him interviewing Chris Akabusi. It's an absolute gem. It's brilliant. Yeah, honestly, I'm not even joking.
No, sure
it's moving and funny. You'll nearly be crying at the end. It's amazing. You've got to hear it.
The only way that the podcast world is going to truly get saved for the future is if we all start recommending things that don't involve famous people's names. Of course, people listening in Preston will be saying that Jamie and I are famous, but of course there's only two people listening in Preston, so that doesn't really matter.
Colin Murray, as in the Irish guy, used to be matched the name
too.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you. Ooh. Is there anything that Matthew can't pour scorn onto?
Are you holding up Colin Murray is an example of, like, the untouchables.
He's an excellent broadcaster.
He certainly is.
I hated him on Match of the Day 2 and on the NFL program as well.
Well, you're probably the reason he lost his job then.
Yeah.
Like, if that's one thing I can hang my hat on, then I can say I've done something in the last few years. That's brilliant.
I think Colin Murray...
achieved something.
Colin Murray is a brilliant broadcaster on the radio. I think he's a brilliant radio broadcaster. But
you know what? Actually, I'll give you that. He is better on the radio.
Yeah, he's not.
He's actually quite enjoyable on the radio, but on TV, he's an irritating little fuck.
Well,
anyway, he cries on that podcast. I think we need to cry more on our podcast.
That's guys. It.
Because he finally gets the text from Match of the Day saying you're fired.
Right, anyway, Mrs. Maisel, finish it, Matt, and everybody else.
Yeah, right,
I'll bloody watch it.
Because for once, it's a show that does as much as it can in every episode instead of spreading it out.
To create another frigging series.
Which is another thing that Aaron Sorkin did really well. His writers would come up with stuff and suggest like 4-episode arcs, and he would put all of it in the episode that they were writing at the time.
Yeah, I just heard that as well. Yeah.
Same thing as Amy Sherman. And that's the thing. I haven't got ADD.
That's just one way of storytelling. That's just one way. There's more than one way to skin a cat.
The good way.
And no,
I forgot we're still having the godless argument.
Unbelievable.
Four more emails this week asking if Matt's watched Godless yet and when that episode's going to be out.
Are you serious?
Yeah. No. Yep.
We got emails asking if I've watched Godless.
Yes, people can't wait.
All right. I mean, I have watched the first episode, but a while ago.
Oh, you have watched the first episode?
Yeah, I said that when we first started talking about it.
Jesus.
I watched one episode, that was it.
And did you pay attention to it, or were you doing something else? Do you need to watch that one again before we talk about it?
I do need to watch it again because it's just a while back, and
okay, watch it again, and then
we'll do a Godless podcast.
There'll
be tears on that pod. There'll be tears.
Also,
okay. Maybe I'll watch a couple of episodes and see if I can really get my teeth into it and decide what I think. But what are we going to talk about next week? Are we talk about Westworld or...
We can do Westworld, Westworld.
Let's do Westworld.
Is Westworld being released one by one?
It's one and one a week.
We're going to have to do episode one, season one, though, guys.
We'll start from the beginning.
Do we really?
Okay, yeah.
Of course, you're not even up there. And also, are we going to do Wild Wild Country at some point?
Yes.
I've
done that. And...
I've just started
there are
that.
Two other things that I'm watching or have just watched. One is called Shot in the Dark. Have you seen that?
No.
That is about the Stringers. You know the film starring Jake Gyllenhaal, the guy who drives around LA trying to film news stories?
Nightcrawler.
Love that film.
Well, the two guys who were real Stringers who were consultants on that film are in this series documentary about Stringers in LA. And...
Interesting.
We've fucking got to do it. And the other one that I'm watching is... Sarah, what are we watching? Oh, 7 Seconds.
Have either of you seen any of The Alienist?
No,
yeah, I watched it all.
You watched it all?
Yeah.
Wow.
I watched the first episode and I went,
Yeah, I don't. It's one of those shows, and I really think we should have a new category. I don't know if I've mentioned this.
Yeah,
a new category of shows, which is
awful.
I watched it, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Okay.
I don't regret watching it, but I wouldn't recommend it because I could fit a lot of shows into that category, and The Alienist is one of those.
Right,
like The Defenders, Luke Cage, Series 2 of Daredevil.
Guys, what about 7 Seconds? Have either of you watched that?
No,
very popular at the moment. We should definitely get on that quick. It's good. It's a crime one, sort of. It's 7 Seconds, Netflix. Have a look. Good rating.
Okay.
I gotta go.
Next week, right. Westworld. Au revoir.
Bye.
Thank you. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to the Box Set Pod. You can email us studio@theboxsetpod.com. Studio. What have you just done?
Just wipe it. As I bent down and I hurt my back.
Oh thank God! You ended with
getting too back. Old for this shit.
That's right. Studio@theboxsetpod.com. Goodbye.
Right, I better go.
Yeah, you better had.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.